Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Singeri. Defunding the police. We heard that phrase a lot last year around the country and in Vermont following the death of George Floyd in Minneapolis. New city and town budgets were proposed across the state and voted on during town meeting day. Now there is sufficient data on local police funding for us to see how the defunding efforts affected those budgets. UVM Center for Research on Vermont has been compiling the numbers, and its report is out today. Joining us to let us know what they found are two of the researchers who worked on the report. First is Valentina Chohansky. Valentina, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And also with us is Katie Rector. Katie, it's great to have you here as well.
Hi, it's great to be here.
That's great to hear. All right, listeners, if you want to ask our guests about the data they collected on municipal police budgets, you can call us at 244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Katie, what data was collected for this report?
Yeah, so we collected about 126 towns worth of data over the past about a year. And over that, we collected the population and the fiscal budgets for the past 4 years and just collected to see the increase and decrease and just looked to see what was going on through the past 4 years.
And Valentina, why was this a project that the Center for Research on Vermont decided to take on?
Well, the Center for Research on Vermont is interested in a lot of broad issues, the conversations we're having about the country. And as you know, Vermont is a really special place. And so the center is really focused on looking at these broader conversations and seeing how they're playing out at the town level. And so we did this project looking across towns, across cities, across the state, and seeing how police budgets were changing, or if they were changing at all.
Mm-hmm. And Valentina, in collecting the data, was it as simple as getting the town warnings or select board minutes, or were there plenty of calls to town clerks to complete the information in the report?
Oh, there was plenty of calls, and we're really grateful for all the clerks and town administrators who were willing to help us compile this data. But I have to say, it's harder than you might think to find all of this data just across towns.
It doesn't say that in the report, but I kind of assumed it, judging from the amount of information that you were able to collect. Katie, you mentioned 126 towns in the report. Now, since town meetings were rescheduled in some places, some budgets get voted down, did this affect being able to collect all the data on a timely basis?
Yeah, so we actually had a first wave of researchers doing research a few months ago, and they were able to collect about 90 towns, and because of the budget changing and passing and not everything being finished, we had to continue the project at a later date. So, yes, it definitely affected the time it took to collect all the data, and there still weren't many budgets that were finished and still don't have data for, which is kind of unfortunate, but I think we have a fair amount of towns to speak on the topic and have enough data to continue our research.
And then once you got that data in, how long did it take to kind of grind through it and, run the numbers?
It definitely took a few weeks to get through the numbers and find what data was standing out and what information we could grasp from what we found. And I think finding like the towns that had more of a, like more than 10% change in their budget was, it wasn't that difficult to find, but once we did, it was very interesting. We had about 14 towns that had a more than 10% change in their budget throughout the fiscal year 21-22. And then we had about 10 towns that had more than a 20% change in their budget over fiscal year 21-22, which was very interesting.
Yeah, it is. Valentina, policing in Vermont's towns comes in different shapes and sizes. So what are the different ways public safety is conducted around the state?
Yeah, so like you said, it can look different for every town. And we really, really got used to trying to figure that out as we're going through town budgets and annual town reports. So for some towns, that looks like one constable, a couple constables, going to have a smaller budget for that. But other towns might have a mix of county sheriffs, their own police departments contracting with the state police department. And so all of these things can contribute to large differences in police service spending for a town. And the other thing is these lists aren't always explicitly written out in a line item in the budget. So it's sometimes hard to decipher why one budget might be so much higher than another. Another thing that we look at for, you know, possible discrepancies in our data is that some towns include in their police budget, you know, benefits or overtime, and that's not always listed whether or not it's included in the budget. So these are all things that, you know, if you see a town and you're interested in this data and why a town might have changed its, you know, its police spending, these are things to look into. And, you know, sometimes it might not be listed on the town website or in the budget. So that's something that, you know, might be worth a call in or talking to someone from the town administration.
And Valentina, did you find any pattern with how funding has been affected for cities and towns in Vermont if they have their own police force as opposed to using county sheriffs or using the Vermont State Police? Was there any trend in one of those specific areas?
Yeah, I can't really speak to any trend on that in particular, just because there is a lot of variation between towns. And like I said, there's different combinations of law enforcement that towns have for themselves. So there's a lot of variety in that.
And then, Katie, you know, talking about trends, did you notice any trends when you compared how Vermont's small towns altered their police budgets as opposed to the larger towns and cities?
Yeah, so we looked a lot about the money of per capita police spending, and you can see that in the larger, most of the larger towns had larger police spending based on because of the population size. And so obviously with a larger population, you'll see like a larger gain in police spending, more people to cover. But it was definitely interesting to see the variation between small towns and some spending a little bit of money, but you're not sure why. And then larger towns not spending as much money and seeing how they're spending your money. But we obviously, as Valentina was saying, there's so many variations that go into why what's going into these police budgets. So we can't really speak on everything that's happening, but there is definitely a trend with larger towns spending more amounts of money, but also there's some small towns spending large amounts of money that we don't really know why, which is interesting.
Okay, but and I understand that's an excellent point. But how about with the changes where, you know, rises in budgeting, you know, have occurred as opposed to decreasing in budgets? Is it happening more in small towns, big towns, or is there no trend line really that indicates it's happening anywhere specifically?
Yeah, so of the towns that we saw more of a 10% increase, it varied between if they were larger towns. So we had some larger cities like Montpelier and East Montpelier that had an increase in budget, but also smaller towns like Granville, Wilmington that also had an increase, but are smaller towns compared to Montpelier, and Waterbury also had an increase, which is a larger town. And then we have the town of Stockbridge, which had the highest increase that we found, which was 1,363%.
Wow. And Stockbridge is not a particularly large town. So that is what seems to be a bit of an outlier. We've got Dale joining us from Burlington. Hi, Dale. Go right ahead.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Excellent topic. Just a question that I have is, did any of the municipal police departments before they started hacking the police budgets ever contact this group for data on what was actually going on out there? And specifically, has Burlington contacted you at all about how the effects of going from close to 100 police officers down to now around 67 or so has affected crime in the city, because living in the city, I can tell you crime is on the rise in a big way. Just wondered if that was part of the data collection.
All right. Thanks for that call and question, Dale. Who wants to handle that? Valentina?
Yeah, I can take the comment.
Sure.
Thank you for asking this question. And to be honest with you, I would say I'm not sure, but I don't think that Burlington in particular has reached out to us for the data project. I will say that would be a question for the director of the Center for Research on Vermont, Richard Locks. But to be honest with you, the research that we do at the center is not generally centered on Burlington. You know, we want to take our time to focus on towns that might not have a lot of press elsewhere. And so Burlington, obviously, as you know, does have, a number of press sources looking at them and keeping track of what's going on there. And I'll also say that this project is, you know, we collected data on how police budgets are changing
right.
over time. And we're focusing on the percent change from the fiscal year 2021 to 2022, looking at the per capita spending. There's a lot of variation with that. We can talk about it later.
Mm-hmm.
But one thing we're not looking at in this particular project is why the towns are changing. You know, that would be a qualitative part of this project that isn't included here. And so we really can't comment on why a town might have changed. You know, this isn't linked to crime rates or anything like that. So.
And Valentina, to further that point, this is specifically, as you mentioned, budget figures. This does not reflect in any way crime figures. That would be a completely different research project. Am I right about that?
You are correct.
Okay. Dale, great questions. And it does bring up, of course, the question, you know, for a need for that kind of study. But just so we're clear, this is not doing that. This was very specifically looking at the budget information, which is now is collected, and they have this body of work. And Katie, Valentina touched on this, but you also tried to stay away from why. The question of why these budgets were affected in the way they were. Am I correct about that?
Yes. It's just hard to tell with so many budgets and going through and finding out all the specifics, especially because not all town budgets are the same, obviously. And we just, not all town budgets put in all the information of what they're spending on, how they're spending it. As Valentina mentioned earlier, some include benefits, some others don't. So it's just hard to judge where this is coming from.
And Dale, I'll mention one more fact. This report is just coming out today. So towns, cities like Burlington are just going to be receiving this information where they can look at and see this snapshot of what's happening around the state. And so they might have questions afterwards, might even have, you might even hear from towns, Valentina, I would think, who say, this budget number was changed, or here is the actual budget number when we take into consideration things like benefits and overtime. Is that correct?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's also something that at the center we welcome that. You know, this is a project we have, for this particular project, we've had multiple teams of researchers over the years adding to it. So, you know, of course it's possible that a number was put in before it was voted on, if it was proposed, you know, mistakes happen, and we welcome changes and comments from anyone who comes across them. So our report has a section for who you can contact if you happen to find an error or you think there's an error in the data.
And Katie, how about if someone wants to access this report that is out now, how does someone get a copy of it or a digital copy that they can start to look over?
Yeah, so we are sending our report out today. I am not completely sure who it's going out to specifically. I'm sure Valentina knows, but in the data it has all the links to how we found our data. We have virtual maps that you can see with all the connections to the data inside and what the towns are specifically spending and what the population is. So, Valentina, do you want to speak on this?
Yeah, so this report is going to be published on the website for the Center for Research on Vermont. And again, that should be happening later today.
Okay,
so
great.
Can keep an eye out for that there.
Perfect. Now, Valentina, let's talk about raw numbers, and then we'll talk to Katie about more weighted figures that she was touching on earlier. But these public safety budgets, when I look at this information you've collected, they can really vary a lot. So give us some of, again, just the totals, the raw numbers of what towns on the low end spend on public safety and the totals of some on the high end around the state.
Yeah, so just for easier access to it, I'll give you some per capita spending, right? So there's a big range of what towns are spending, and, you know, that could depend by population. But not always. So if on average we found town residents are spending about $115 per capita for police services. But while that might be an average $115, the range, you know, could be as high as some towns spending $400 per person. And you'll have that in several towns and cities, while other towns spend under $10 per capita. Some spend, you know, less than a dollar, or some towns spend nothing at all on police services. So that should give you a little touch at the variety of spending that's really happening.
Katie, who are the towns that are spending, you know, at that very low end, you know, $0 or $10 per person? Are they in small towns? What do we know about those on the very low end?
It is majority so towns. I will say Bolton is their per capita spending that we found was zero. Addison was zero. Canton was around $10. Charlotte was around 21 cents.
Hmm.
Fairfield was around $0. So it's definitely some smaller town. Charlotte is known to be a more populous town, but again, it definitely changes. It's not all based on population, but as you can see, there's also larger towns that are smaller towns that are spending more per capita. Like Dover is spending around $600 that we found. Windhoe is spending a little over $1,000 per capita, which is with a very small population of 600 people. That makes sense.
Yeah,
but it's definitely variation, and with a larger budget, it definitely changes based on population, and it just definitely affects if a smaller town is, you can say they're spending maybe around the same as Charlotte, it could definitely come up as more per capita spending just because of the population difference.
Valentina, you looked at how these budgets have changed. So what were some of the most severe drops that you saw in a town's police budget? What were some of the most severe increases that you saw?
Yeah, so as Gideon said earlier, we had, you know, a little over a dozen towns that saw increases of more than 10%. And 10 towns that saw decreases of more than 20%. Hmm. Some of those bigger decreases were in town of Rutland, Underhill, St. Albans City, Arlington, Montgomery, and, you know, some of the larger increases we saw in Hinesburg, East Montpelier, Waterbury, Thetford, St. Albans Town. And again, just going back to Stockbridge, which is a great, you know, outlier we found.
Mm-hmm.
So Stockbridge, small town, we have the population a little over 700 or a little under 700. And the increase, as Katie mentioned, was 1,300.
Wow. That's okay.
So 1,300% increase. And the per capita spending with that increase is still $12. You know, so because the town is small, a change would reflect the percentage change a lot higher. These are all things to look at, the nitty gritty.
Katie, was there anything that you found most interesting or surprising with the data that you collected for this report?
Yeah, I mean, I think the most interesting thing to me was I went into this expecting some of the larger cities to be spending more than the smaller towns. And I wasn't, being from Vermont, I wasn't really sure how it was going to, I was going to see finding the data. I was expecting the small towns to not be spending as much. And to have with the combined police departments in all the small towns. But I think it was very interesting to see that there are smaller towns spending more money, and there are, and just the what the little differences can make. Like in Stockbridge, all they did was add a county sheriff, and it had that large increase in the data. So I thought that was really interesting.
And Valentina, we have about a minute left. You've now collected the data. It will be released to everyone later today. But what happens with the data, you know, once you've collected this? Where does it go? How do you expand on it? What's your next step?
Yeah, well, so next steps after it's going to be sent out, you know, people have access to it. And we're happy to, you know, answer other questions about it from anyone who's interested. But the next steps for this project itself is, you know, continuing this data collection, because a data set like this is really valuable, I think, when it's consistent over a number of years. And so we've had teams of researchers collecting this data for the past few years. And, you know, this report has 126 towns, but, you know, we're hoping to continue expanding on that and, you know, in the future to keep collecting data for the towns that we have and hopefully more to get an even better snapshot of what's happening in the state.
Valentina Johansky and Katie Rector are two of the researchers who worked on Budgets for Police Services, a review of 126 Vermont towns. It's a report compiled by UVM's Center for Research on Vermont. Valentina and Katie, thanks so much for putting this together and being on the program this morning.
Thanks for having us.
All right, take care. Bye now. We're going to get a CBS News update, and then we'll talk to the owner of Pathpaws in Moncton about pack walks, training dogs, and more. And coming up today at 1 o'clock on WDEV, it's the granddaddy of them all, a full 3 hours of The Getaway with Greg Hooker. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. We're going to get to the dogs in just a second, but we did promise you earlier that as soon as we had news about Thunder Road tonight, we would let you know, and Lee Cattell is here to share some.
Hey, Rick. I'm here bringing blue news for this Thursday.
No.
Yes, indeed. WDEV Night at Thunder Road has been postponed. The rescheduled date is Friday night, September 10th. Friday night, September 10th. So those folks who won tickets from us, they are good for Friday night, September 10th. And they are still on for this Sunday, the Enduro. Wild horses couldn't drag that one away. That's a rain or shine deal.
All right, good.
But well, the WDEV night rained out tonight, Friday, September 10th, post time, 7 o'clock.
All right, thanks for that update, Lee. Oh, wouldn't you know, I'm on vacation that week, and I'll be back in Pennsylvania soon. All right, we're going to get now to the dogs. You know, we love our dogs, but sometimes we don't get them out there for the walks that we need. Or they need, and some of our beloved pooches could use a bit of behavior modification, maybe more than we ourselves are capable of giving them. So we're going to spend time this morning talking to someone who handles these tasks and does so with great ease. She gets dogs, and they get her. And listeners, if you've got questions about training your dog, you'll want to pay attention and call in with a question for our guests. Our number's 244-1770. 877-291-8255. You can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. With me now to discuss these subjects is Liz Ducharme. She's the owner of Pathpaws VT in Moncton. Liz, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Hi, Rick.
Hey,
good to be here.
Sorry you were preempted by that big racing announcement, but
no.
These things happen. Now let's talk about dogs. I can't imagine, you know, that my intro to what you do at Pathpaws did it justice. So tell us exactly what your company is and what you do.
Yeah, so I do two things, really. I
take groups of dogs out for two-hour-long hikes during the week, Monday through Friday. We work on all sorts of things when we're out there, and they go home tired. I think that's what my clients love the most. They can come home from work, and their dog isn't raring to go for a walk after a long day at the office. And then on the side, I do some training to help people with some, you know, some behavior problems that they may be facing.
And Liz, what led you to develop a company that offered these services, and when did you get started doing it?
Well, I've always loved dogs. You know, they're pretty great. Yeah. I think most of our listeners can agree. It's just been a passion of mine my entire life. So, you know, I think the biggest thing was I had a dog who I was struggling with, and he kind of led me on the path to figure them out a little bit better and see how I could help other people do that.
Now, I like dogs, but to be around so many almost every single day, it requires a devotion to the dog that's pretty deep. And I would think you must absolutely love dogs.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That's putting it lightly, I think. So most days I'm with big groups of dogs, and you know, it's just the highlight of my day.
And when you talk about packs of dogs, you know, what kind are they? I mean, do you have similar small dogs together, or do you take whatever you have and, you know, and form a pack? Is there, what kind of combination of dogs do you put together for these pack walks?
Well, it's interesting you say that, because certainly different personalities do better in, you know, together than others. So, I take all sorts of dogs as long as they're appropriate for what we're doing. And I know one day I have my herding dogs. They all have very similar personalities, so I try to keep them together. But really, I take all sorts of dogs, mutts, labs, goldens. Yeah.
Now, do you ever run into dogs that even try your patience for pack walks?
Well, you know, there's always dogs that have their days, just like people do. So I wouldn't say they try my patience. I try to understand where they're coming from. And, you know, if we can figure out what emotion they're having, we can kind of address the behavior that way. So I think I look at it a different way. And I don't think they would ever, you know, try my patience, I guess.
All right. You have a great soul, I can tell already. Well, let's talk about these walks. You know, how long are they? How many go with you at a time? And where do you go?
Yeah, so I take usually between 6 and 8 dogs with me in my car. And we, after pickup, we get to our location. We walk only on private land. I don't imagine your regular hiker wants to run into a big group of dogs.
They've got to love them as much as you do.
Yeah, not everybody does.
Right.
That's fine. So we have a couple different spots that we like to go to, and we will hike for 2 hours, always 2 hours, rain or shine or snow. Mm. And by the time we get back to the car, they just hop right back in, and they're ready to go home and sleep.
All right, let's take a call. We've got Diana joining us from Moncton. Hi, Diana. Go right ahead.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for having me on.
Sure.
Actually, Liz walked my dog, and I was actually just going to give a shout-out for what a change she has made in our lives. We've always had a lot of rescues, so 4 to 5 dogs at a time, and it was always managing dogs, but we got desperate during the pandemic and reached out to Liz because we were having some conflict, and if it wasn't for her, she changed our whole life. She taught us how to help our dog, like, manage themselves, mm-hmm. how to manage their stress. She is just amazing.
Well, Diana, tell us a little bit more about, you know, some of the effective things that she taught you that have worked with your dogs.
Oh, my goodness. She taught us to help our dogs calm themselves. So when they're feeling stressed, when they're feeling anxious, she taught us these techniques where they can, when they get overstressed, overstimulated, they just, like, learn to relax on their own. Like, they go to their happy place. It is amazing. It's like meditation for dogs. She changed their whole life.
Wow, Diana.
Yeah. five dogs stuck in a house and two people during a pandemic, it can get tense.
That is a recipe for some anxiety. Liz, thanks for that call, Diana. Liz, talk about that. You know, that idea of, you know, dogs being anxious, you know, and revved up, and how you figure out and teach their owners to get them to kind of calm down on their own.
Yeah, so a lot of these behaviors that we see dogs doing, they come from a place of anxiety, and it's hard to recognize, I think, for most owners that their dogs have anxiety, but they do. And so what I try to do is teach the owners how to teach their dogs to relax when faced with stressful situations or, you know, high anxiety times. And by teaching the dog to choose relaxation over reaction or, you know, barking, lunging, that sort of thing, mm-hmm. the dog over time learns to enjoy that sort of peace of mind. And so they'll make better choices on their own once we give them the tools to learn that.
Wow. All right. We're going to take another call. We got Steven joining us for now from Montpelier. Hi, Steven. Go right ahead.
Hi, Rick. I just want to comment about my dog, Riley.
Mm-hmm.
In the morning at 7:30, we feed him. And then I go out, walk around the pit. We have this gravel pit.
Mm-hmm.
And then I go up out of the pit, and he gets the paper. And the paper man always has a biscuit in the paper. With the paper. So he brings the paper up the driveway, and we read the paper. And then at 12:30, I send it back down, and he waits for the mail lady. And he sits down at the bottom of the driveway, and eventually the mail lady comes, and she puts the mail in his mouth. And then he brings the mail up to the house. And then in the afternoon, I quite often walk with a neighbor at 2, and we walk around the pit a few times. And then at 5 o'clock, he gets his dinner, and we take a walk around the pit. And then my wife and I drink beer and have dinner.
And Riley does not have a beer.
Oh,
Stephen, thanks for that. Now, this brings up some very interesting stuff. And I know Stephen isn't giving Riley a beer at the end of the day. But the things he mentions, Liz, mail delivery, paper delivery, those are two real triggers to a lot of dogs. I know I delivered newspapers as a kid. And I know mail delivery people who have to worry about some dogs. How do you work with a dog who might have negative reactions to delivery people, and to have them react the way Steven's dog does?
Well, it sounds like Steven's dog has a really great habit. So that dog is forming some really positive associations with the delivery people. Mm-hmm. You know, she's getting a biscuit each time, and so in her brain, she's having all these positive interactions. The problem is when dogs don't have those positive interactions and they start to form negative associations. So I go in and I try to change their perception a little bit, but it has to be a slow ease into a new way of thinking. I do use a lot of food. dogs love food. It's very motivating for them.
Ah, interesting.
So yeah, we try to find what motivates the dog, and we try to pair that with a different scenario. So say a dog is barking at a mailman, and the mailman comes, drops off the mail, and leaves. The dog, over time, has learned my barking has caused the mail person to leave. So they're going to keep doing that. So we try to break that up with a slow ease into perception modifications. We're going to change the way the dog is thinking, and hopefully change the reaction.
Mm. Liz, do you have a specific philosophy or school of thought when it comes to training dogs?
Ew.
true, Rick. I feel that a lot of times people focus a lot on the behavior that they're seeing in the dog and not the emotion that the dog is having. So I try to address the emotions in the dog, and typically you see the behaviors you don't like just kind of go away over time.
And you talk about understanding their feelings, the dog's feelings, which I've never really thought about. I've never even considered that. How do you understand the feelings of a dog when you see them in a particular emotional state?
Yeah, so a lot of times it's their body language, you know, how their posture is. You can a lot of times tell if the dog is scared, and that's why they're acting aggressively. And I think it's very common for people to see aggressive behavior and think that the dog is being aggressive when really it's feeling insecure and scared, and that's why it's being a little bit more defensive. Those are the dogs that I really tend to be passionate about.
Now, I'm sure you hear a lot of myths, I'll say, that, you know, people believe about dog training, and I'd love to hear any you want to talk about and how you respond to those.
Sure. Yeah, it can be tough because a lot of times people have very strong viewpoints on these things. One common one, though, is, you know, I mentioned the dog who's on a leash and it might be barking or lunging. A lot of times people say that their dog is protecting them.
Right.
But oftentimes it's true that the dog is trying to protect itself. And I think when we look at it that way from the dog's viewpoint, we can be more efficient in training the dog.
And how about another myth that you've heard?
Another myth. Yeah. I have heard a lot that dogs are, you know, when they're having some problematic behavior at home, they might be trying to assert their role in the pack or
right.
their dominance. That one gets me just because, you know, dogs know that they're not humans and they know that we're not dogs. So I do like to explain that to people that, you know, they know we're separate and their behavior is completely separate from their role in the pack.
Interesting.
So that was a big one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah. So dogs know they're dogs, folks, and they know that you are not a dog. They can ascertain that. That is really interesting stuff. Let's look at some of the specific areas that you do concentrate on, in behavior modification. And one that, you know, especially now, Liz, because of people returning to work after being home during the pandemic, we heard from, a caller earlier, you know, about having two people, five dogs in the house, but and separation anxiety. How do you deal with something like that?
Separation anxiety is tough. And yes, it's certainly quite prevalent now. Dogs were home with people a lot during the pandemic and not really exposed to alone time. And so that is one of the hardest things to help a dog through. It's very slow. And a lot of people get very discouraged during training for separation anxiety. But it can be done, and it just takes time and patience, slow, gradual desensitizing the dog to alone time. And it can be done. So anybody out there dealing with separation anxiety, just be patient is my best advice.
All right. Now, here's one that I have difficulty with, not with dogs, but me coming when called. So if you have a dog that doesn't come when called, how would you work with them to pay attention and do what you want to get them to come back to you?
Yeah. So a lot of times dogs don't come when called because they just simply haven't been taught to. I think people think that when the dog knows its name, they should just automatically know what that means. But the dog doesn't. So repetition, you know, practice in low distraction settings where the dog is set up to succeed, boost its confidence, you know, make a party when the dog comes back, give it a treat or whatever motivates your dog. For me, I classically condition the dogs to
come when called. When they hear their name, they come and get a treat. So they think food when they hear their name. So that's how I do it. But certainly there are other methods, and the dog just has to learn. And I think, you know, the more practice you put in, the better recall your dog will have.
Now, I want to talk about puppies. Are there training differences, you know, when you train a puppy to an older dog? Is it really important to have a dog trained as a puppy and not wait till it has developed certain characteristics or tendencies?
Yes. Puppies are wonderful.
Yes.
But with all the rescue pups these days, some do come with a little bit of baggage. Mm-hmm. But certainly I think puppies, it's really important to socialize them during their crucial, that little window that they have where they're just little sponges and, you know, they're just eating up all this information. And I think it's really important to set them up to have very high confidence. You know, let them win a lot, let them explore, but in a safe way. You don't want to bring your puppy out and about and have, you know, some not controlled scenarios happen and the dog gets scared, because those things stick with puppies. And I think it's really important for puppies to have a really positive experience early on. Any training should be done early, and all positive stuff.
And however, you say let them, go ahead.
Oh, yeah. No, I think puppies, it's good for them to, you know, also learn resiliency. Mm-hmm. So they should, you know, be able to bounce back from stressful situations and stuff like that.
We've got about 30 seconds left. When you say let them win a lot, we're not going to sit down and play Parcheesi, and I'm going to hold back. So what does that mean?
Well, you know, it's the same as if you're playing a board game with a young child. You know, you don't want to be the one to win all the time, and,
right,
and then have your child feel like, I never want to do this again. So, you know, if you're playing tug, let the puppy win. Let them think they're big and strong.
Build that confidence. I like that. Liz Ducharme is owner of Pathpaws VT in Moncton, and you can learn more about the services she offers. The website is pathpawsvt.com. Liz, thanks so much for helping us with our pooches this morning.
Oh, no problem. Thanks so much for having me on.
Oh, it was great having you. All right, listeners, Sox, one more game against those Blue Jays. That's tonight at Fenway. Our coverage begins at 6:10, and first pitch is 7:10. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. All right, we have some time for open phones this morning. 244-1777, 877-291-8255. Got some great calls yesterday talking about your choice for a vanity plate or some that you've seen. We heard from one fellow whose friend has the Santa plate, the Vermont Santa plate. I saw one in Chittenden County for Jesus. Or Jesus, could have been either one. We also were taking suggestions on places you take out-of-state guests, 877-291-8255. I do want to let you know, we announced this a little earlier, but the WDEV Calkins Night at Thunder Road, scheduled for this evening, has been postponed. It will be run on September 10th, so if you were thinking of creating one of those portable toilets, you have a little bit time, more time to work on it. You got about 5 weeks now, so get going. But I should tell you that the Balduck Metal Recycling Enduro 200 on Sunday, and the Street Stock Special that's going on Sunday. Those are still on, and they're a lot of fun. The Enduro is wild. The Enduro 200, the People's Race, about 100 cars are expected, and they run around the track to try to win $3,000 in cash prizes to the winner. And there's also the RK Miles Street Stock Open that will open the program. That's a 50-lap showdown. If you've ever raced in that Enduro, I'd love to hear from you and let us know what it's like and why you would do such a thing. It's fun to watch, but, boy, I really feel for all those cars, those drivers out there. You know, and if you've ever done it, I'd love to pick your brain a little. Or if you've been in the Calkins Portable Toilets race, that would be fun to hear from somebody who's done that as well. That could be pretty wild. All right, let's see. What else do we have? A couple things I want to take care of from yesterday's program. Cindy called from Facedon, and I want to let you know, Cindy, I have now brought in, I had the program at home for Festival of Fools. So if you'd like that, if you didn't find a copy of it, and you're in Waterbury today or tomorrow, it's downstairs right on the front counter here on our office. And you can, it's got your name written on it. You can pick that up and maybe plan for this weekend. Festival of Fools starting tomorrow afternoon, running through Sunday evening in downtown Burlington there on Church Street. Should be a wild time. And we also had a call from Nancy, I think it was Nancy from Hardwick, during our time talking about legislature, the bills they passed that affect agriculture. And Nancy called in and wanted to know about getting support to fix up an old barn. And Nancy, if you're listening, call in and leave your number with Danny, and I'll call you after the show. One of our listeners called in later in the 11 o'clock hour and left a number with Danny, says he's been through what you're going through, has some information for you. So if you leave your information with Danny, I'll call you with the digits of this listener who might actually have some helpful information with what you're going through. Vermonters helping Vermonters. I absolutely love it. All right. We've got the phones open at 244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can email vtviewpoint at radiovermont.com. And we just heard about training dogs, taking dogs on pack walks. If you want to share your dog stories, love to hear them. Those are fantastic while we've got the phones open. Last night I had another family Zoom call. We have now probably been doing the family Zoom call, for about a year consistently. Might have missed one or two times, but we've, expanded it to broader, on the holidays and tried to get, you know, families, members who aren't in on our regular weekly Zoom calls. Are you still doing that? Are you still using Zoom to keep in touch with family, even as things are opening up with the pandemic? We started it last year about this time as my mother became ill, and we lost her during that time in January. But it has been a great thing for my family to continue these calls, keep in touch with one another, share the love. Very interesting during these calls, depending on who's in the call, you see different dynamics. You know, on certain days when certain people are on the call, they kind of, I don't want to say dominate the conversation, but let's just say have an awful lot to say. And when they're not there, you see other people step up and kind of fill that void and talk quite a bit. And I've noticed from different Zoom calls that I've done, including some with high school friends, there are some people, and I really always worry about them because they barely speak. They are there kind of consistently, you know, call in as often as they possibly can, but don't always have anything to offer. And yet they just listen and enjoy, I think, hearing what's going on with everyone. All right, we've got the phones open right now at 244-1777, 877-291-8255. And looks like we're getting a call in now, so we'll get on to that in just a sec. And you can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Steven's joining us from Montpelier. Hi, Steven. Go right ahead.
I just have a quick suggestion for visitors to Vermont.
Yes.
And that is the Connecticut River Paddlers Trail.
Oh, yeah.
And if you go to the Vermont River Conservancy site, there's a map of all the campsites. You can go overnight for one night or just for a day. There's a map of all the put-ins and the boat launches and all the islands where they're campsites. So that's a fun thing to do. You know, visitors, whether they want to go for just a day or a couple days, or, and then there are also vendors that rent kayaks and canoes.
Steven, I love this suggestion because tomorrow I'm actually going to have a guest on who's written a book called Walking Home, and she hiked the long trail, her and a friend, and they did it in sections. They didn't through hike it, but they went from the Mass border up to the Canadian border. And we think a lot about that with hiking, but not as much with paddling. And so with the Connecticut River Paddlers Trail, how far north, do you start? Do you get up to the beginning up in the, what are those ponds up there? Or is it,
You can start at the Connecticut Lakes,
way up. That's it. Yeah.
In New Hampshire.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can paddle all the way to Long Island Sound.
Incredible. How much have you done of it? Have you done the whole thing?
No, I haven't. But I've done various segments over the years.
Yeah. Any particular favorites?
Well, of course, Stevens Island is named after me.
Of course.
Since I founded the Vermont River Conservancy many years ago.
Is that true that it was named after you, or are you just...
No, I'm not making that up.
Oh, I love that. Where is that?
That's right across Monroe, New Hampshire.
All right. Wow. All right. I've had a sandwich.
And it's a wonderful place because there are Canadian yews and huge pine trees, but the Canadian yews are very, very soft. So you barely need a pad for sleeping bags. You can just sleep on the Canadian yews.
Oh, wow. Oh, that sounds fabulous. Wow. Stephen, another great suggestion of where to take somebody if you've got visiting or if you just want to go out yourself. You love paddling the Connecticut River Paddlers Trail. And you said the Vermont River Conservancy website will have information on that.
It'll have a map and everything you need to know.
All right. Outstanding. Thanks for that suggestion. And say hi to Riley for us now.
I shall.
All right. We've got the phones wide open awaiting your calls. For your thoughts about great places to take Vermont visitors or some vanity plate suggestions, as always, open phones mean open subjects as well. 244-1777, 877-291-8255. Our email is vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. In the 9:30 segment this morning, we heard from Liz Ducharme from PathPaws VT talking about dog behavior. And yeah, I said you can call in with dog stories if you'd like. I learned something when I've mentioned that my sister and brother-in-law were here about a week and a half ago. And we were talking about dogs at one point during the many hours I was driving them around Vermont. And my sister, when we were young, we had two dogs. First we had Buttons and then we had Taffy, the only two dogs we had. And Buttons followed my sister to school one day when she was in kindergarten. And the dog got hit by a car and we lost Buttons. Our next dog, Taffy, stuck around for a good number of years, but when she started to kind of slow down and get sick, unbeknownst to me, it was a day my sister and I had both had off from school. you know, I was at the house and my sister said, they're coming to get Taffy today. No one told me this. Taffy was kind of my dog. And they were taking Taffy to a farm, which I think we all know what that euphemism means. I did not at that time. But I couldn't stand to be there when they came to pick up our dog, Taffy. And so I feel really kind of cruel and terrible about this, but I left. I couldn't stay there. And my poor sister had to stay as they came and collected our dog. So the two dogs we had as kids, my sister had to be there at the end for our family of both of them. And as we're driving around Vermont, you know, we talked about dogs, and she said something about wanting a dog. And I said, really? She said, I have wanted another dog my whole life. And it's not what I would have thought. I would have thought that she would have been the person to never have another dog. So I hope she does get that opportunity sometime soon. But very interesting. I had assumed that dogs were the last thing she'd want because of the experiences that she did have in her life. But no, she loves dogs and wants them, and just proves kind of to how much dogs can really lift us. And I'd love to hear stories from you about that. We heard about Stephen Hunick when he was recovering from, I think, heart surgery, maybe bypass surgery, and his dog was there. Sandy, was it? Was there with him just the whole time. And he always credited his dog with bringing him back to health, which is kind of wonderful. So, boy, could be a good time to hear from our friends at the Central Vermont Humane Society, wouldn't it? They usually have a few pups and dogs and cats there that could, you know, really ready for adoption and could brighten your life. All right, we're at 244-1777-877-291-8255. And I'd love to hear from you because, you know, if you don't call in, you know what happens. You know I have to fill up the next 10 minutes and you've got to listen to me just natter on for a good long time. You never want that, right? We'll get back to what's happening at Thunder Road tonight. After we go to Newbury and speak to its Duke Fred, the Duke of Newbury. What's going on?
Oh, pretty good.
Good.
Hey, it is a great day today.
It is.
You know that? Yeah, I made it down for breakfast.
Well done, Fred. What do you have?
Yeah. Hey, you know what? Here's what you ought to do, really.
Okay.
You ought to get yourself a topo map out, and then find a section of woods that doesn't have any, you know, houses in it or built up area in it.
It's, right.
You can look at a topo map, and if it looks all green, that means it's got a section of woods in it. And then you look and you see if you can find like a cross road from where you are to another cross road that goes into the section of wood, goes through the section of wood. And then plot a course on it, like you'd draw a line on it, and then you'd calculate what the azimuth of that line is. And then you would hike that line with a compass and your map and then see if you can make it to this other crossroad.
Wow.
And make sure that it's at least 1,000 meters. And it is so much fun. And if you don't do it right, you can get lost.
That's what I'm a little worried about. There's, it's not like a trailhead where you can sign in and somebody knows you're going. So,
you can tell somebody where you're going. Like
probably should.
You know what I mean? You know, the corner of, I don't know, one street or one road and another road. And then you're going to go through that plot of woods all the way up to, this other road where it has a intersection.
Yeah. Well, right off the top of my bean, Fred, you know, there's places like Glastonbury, Lewis, Somerset, different parts of the state. I think Ferdinand's another one, where you shouldn't have any problem finding, a stretch of land like that, that you're describing. You know, so it sounds like a really great adventure. You got to have some skills though, right, Fred?
Well, actually, all you have to do is just get the map and then draw a line from your position to the position you want to get out of.
Right.
Get out of, yeah. And then you calculate what the azimuth of that line is, and then you follow that azimuth on your compass.
Oh, okay.
And you probably should use magnetic north.
Yeah. Fred, have you done this anywhere?
Yes. Yeah, I have. I used to do it before we had GPS.
Oh, no kidding.
I had some friends, and I said to them, I said, look, we'll go from this pond here, and then we went over to another intersection that was at least 1,000 meters. And I plotted it, and then I followed it with my compass. And I had an altimeter with me. And so as we went along, what I did was I set the altimeter to the elevation where the start point was, and then got on the azimuth, followed the azimuth, and then we walked about maybe 25 minutes. I'd stop, and then I'd check the altimeter, and if the altimeter said I was 800 feet, I'd look at the top of lines,
yep.
You know, see them, and then if my course crossed that top line that was 800 feet, that's where I'd be.
Oh, that's so cool. What's the neatest thing you've seen doing something like that, Fred?
The neatest thing that I've seen doing something like that, I can't remember because it's all woods.
Yeah, well,
once in a while you might run into a bog, or you might run into a low place that's not on the map.
Right.
And the reason why it wasn't on the map is probably dries out, you know, in the summertime, and they never got it on.
Yeah, maybe a vernal pool.
That's right. That's exactly right.
Yeah. Ever run into like a moose or a fisher or something cool like that?
That's interesting. One time I was out with my wife, and we were taking a break, and we were sitting down. And I'm trying to think. I think we were in either New Hampshire or Vermont. And we're sitting down. She was had her back up against one tree. I had my back up against a tree that was just beside her. And we were facing, and we just sat there and we're looking at the trees and hearing the birds. And we saw a fisher cat go down right in front of us and popped away. And he never saw us at all.
Wow. Oh, that's a great story. That's worth the price of admission this morning. Fred, listeners are calling in. They want to know, since you made it down for breakfast, what did you have for breakfast?
I had porridge and some, English muffins.
Nice.
With peanut butter.
All right. That's what the Duke eats over there in Newbury. Hey, that's a great call. Thanks so much, Fred.
Okay.
All right. There's a suggestion. You know, it depends how hardy you are. Like I said, tomorrow we'll hear from the author of a book, and she and a friend hiked the Long Trail. But if you're looking for an off-trail adventure, Fred gives you a great suggestion. We have plenty of room in this state to do something like that. I would suggest, though, that you do let people know where you are, because so many of the spots that Fred, you know, describes are probably going to have little or no cell reception, and you just do want to make sure. You probably want to start out early in the day as well, so that you're not, out there in the middle of the night as your adventure unfolds. But boy, that sounds great. And the fact that Fred and his wife got to see a fisher, I got to do a show on fishers. I absolutely love them. I've only seen once run across in front of my car across I-89. I was heading up to the airport one morning. This is when I lived in Montpelier. And it was that time of day. They're kind of active early, just kind of at dawn. And one darted right across in front of my car. A really incredible animal. And if you don't know fishers, or also known as fisher cats, as Fred referred to them, they're an incredible animal, very strong. And I think they get blamed for a lot of things they don't do. But They are part of our ecosystem here in Vermont and in New England, and a good thing to understand. I didn't see him as close as Fred and his wife. That would have been a lot of fun. All right, let's close the faucet for today of open phones. Thanks so much for calling in. We're going to take a break, and then we've got Charlotte Strasser. She's going to come up to the Dump Studio, and she's got some great sound clips that she has dredged up from the WDEV archives as we celebrate our 90th anniversary. And coming up today at 11, we've got Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre. And a reminder that tonight's Thunder Road WDEV Calkins Night, this has been postponed to September 10th. That's a Friday night. But things still going on this weekend. The ACT Tour Midsummer Classic 250 at White Mountain Motorsports Park on Saturday. That's still on. The Balduck Metal Recycling Enduro on Sunday at Thunder Road. That is still on. All right. This is WDEV, and you're listening to Vermont Viewpoint.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. The audio archive of WDEV is vast and varied. Decades of audio recordings have yielded some real gems. Included are historically significant events. We're also going to make some, WDEV memories can be heard Monday through Friday at 7:40 and at 4:40 as part of our 90 years of broadcasting. And all that is underwritten by Sticks and Stuff and Country Home Center. Want to give them a nod. But someone had to dig through all those dusty boxes. They had to pull them from cobwebbed corners and listen to hours of audio captured on a variety of mediums. And that person is WDEV's Director of Operations, Charlotte Strasser. She joins us now to talk about the search and to play some of the clips for us. Charlotte, thanks for doing all that and being on the show today.
It's been really fun, I have to admit. I'm not going to lie.
Oh, good.
Although,
this is
dirty.
This is
your right.
Yeah, dirty.
Cobwebby. There are some days when I was routinely going downstairs to wash my hands after I had touched everything, but it has been fun.
Oh, good. Listeners, if you want to ask Charlotte about her audio archive retrieval or her about her career here at WDEV, you can give us a call. 244-1777, 877-291-8255. As I mentioned the other day when we had Kaya on, we're going to have some of the stars of WDEV through the years. We'll have them on for the next year. You get to hear from them and talk to them. Charlotte, when did you start at WDEV?
1998.
And what was that job?
Copywriter, just like Kaya.
Just like Kaya.
Yeah.
Did you replace her or
no?
Or
no, she was doing traffic at that point.
Oh, okay.
I don't know who I replaced. They weren't here when I came in. And I don't remember all the details of my interview outfit like Kaya did. All I really remember is I think it was in September I interviewed.
Oh, yes. Okay, that's good. And then did you leave for a while? This is your second tour of duty at WDEV?
It is. I was here 10 years, and then I left for 7 years, and I've been back for 6 years now.
What did you do in the interim?
I worked as a private contractor, but I worked with Cabot Creamery.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah.
Oh, good for you.
Yeah, it's hard to convince people to eat good cheese.
Yeah.
Tough job.
I have said this before. Since the day I've gotten to Vermont, that's over 18 years, there has been a Cabot product in my refrigerator every single day. I can tell now if I'm getting low on like some sliced cheddar or something, I run out and get it some sour cream or something. I've got to make sure that I have got Cabot in my fridge.
I just found the new mac and cheese yesterday. Oh. I bought 10 boxes.
You got to tell me where you found them. I bought 6 and I had to ship 3 to Pennsylvania to my niece. They are outstanding. I absolutely love them. All right. Now, Director of Operations sounds incredibly responsible. What are things that fall under that purview for you?
I think basically it just comes down to I'm not afraid to go down into the basement and find the water meter or dig through boxes and, you know, use the little stringy lights.
So they looked around the building and they said, is there anybody who will go and do that job? And you raised your hand. You're like, I'm not afraid. I'll go do it. That's what got you the gig?
Yeah.
All right, good. Now, we're going to talk about collecting that audio. What did that require?
Well, we have the building here at Stowe Street, which is a basement and then two other levels, a mezzanine level, and technically the newsroom is not in this building. It's in 7th Stowe Street. So we've got all of this building, part of another building. We have the transmitter building on Blush Hill.
Right.
There is stuff in all of them, in all of the rooms, tucked away in corners. So basically, I had to try to find where all this stuff was. Some of it's obvious. Like over by the newsroom, there's shelves and shelves of reel-to-reel tape.
You mean this isn't all codified and cataloged?
No. Some of it's not even labeled. So it was a matter of finding all these things. At first, just finding what looked like it might be good.
Yeah.
And then afterwards, I've gone back subsequently and found stuff that just doesn't look like it might be good just to listen to it. But finding all of it, and like you said, it's on every kind of different medium. We've got records. We've got reel-to-reel tape. We've got DAT tape. We've got cassette tape. We've got CDs. We have carts. Trying to listen to all of that, get all the machines hooked up to do all that. Yeah, it's a lot of stuff. It's really overwhelming, and I don't even think I'm maybe a third of the way through everything we have here.
Oh, my gosh. Was there anything you found where we didn't have a player for, like something like a stylus that was cut into a wax cylinder or something?
Well, we have some of the big old records that are too big to play on a standard turntable now. They only play on the big turntables that are up at the transmitter side in Blush Hill, which I don't even think are hooked up anymore. And we have DAT tapes, which seem to have a very short period of time where they were used. I don't even think we have a DAT player around here anymore. But a lot of the material we have are on old reel-to-reel tapes, and they don't age so well. So even if we have the physical tape, sometimes it's degraded so badly, it's sticky, it won't play off the reel, or it's so fragile, it breaks. Mm. So that's been a challenge, too.
Oh, my gosh. Wow. Well, kudos to you, Charlotte, for doing all that. Was there any audio that you heard and you were just, like, totally blown away by it when you heard it?
Yes. We had a recording from the 50th anniversary of the flood of 1927. They did a remembrance program at the elementary school up here on Stowe Street. And it was a cassette tape, I believe. And I grew up here in Waterbury, so I'd heard about the flood of 27 my whole life. But it was kind of one of those things like you heard about it so much it didn't really register with you. And I didn't really know the intimate stories. So I'm listening to this tape, and these people are recollecting what it was like, you know, to live through the flood. And one of the stories was just so powerful. I was sitting in the mezzanine studio, which is kind of isolated, and I remember backing my chair up and looking around thinking, is anyone else hearing what I'm hearing? It's almost like I needed the emotional support of having someone there to listen to this with me. And if we could listen to it right now,
yeah.
I'd like to.
Danny, you ready for us? Let's hear
it. I just preface it by saying it's about 4 minutes long. You kind of have to do focus to listen to it. And I cut off the beginning audio because it was a little rough sounding. So where we enter this recollection, it's Orlando Robbins. He worked at the power plant at the state hospital. He started his shift at 6 o'clock on November 3rd, 6 p.m. Flood water was already covering the floor of the power plant. He and his coworker were securing the boiler because they knew, you know, flooding was occurring. And they're in total darkness at this point, and this is where we pick up the audio.
Okay, thanks.
We immediately went on top of the boiler, and I get probably the boiler 14, 15 feet from the floor. We sat there and talked. Of course, we didn't realize that the water was going to come up to any extent. And Henry Wallace was the engineer there at that time. And Henry spoke and says there was a light out there in the river. Then we could hear somebody holler. And a man came down the river. Seemed to us as if it was towards the powerhouse rather than in the riverbed. But regardless, he was on some sort of a roof. And he was hollering for help. Well, Henry and I had a little argument of whether I should go out and get him because I was a good swimmer. But we decided that we couldn't make it, so we let the poor devil go. Well, we sat there and talked back and forth for a while, and Henry says, "I'm sitting in water." I put my hand down on the brick where we were sitting, and sure enough, there was an inch and a half of water there. The brick had been warm enough so we didn't see it. So we got up onto the boiler itself, and that was 3 foot or so higher. And eventually the water got there, so we got up onto the 18th main coming from the boilers. And we sat there. We didn't have too much to say, you know. We had our thoughts of our own. Something struck the building. It shook. You can't imagine the terrible tremor. And that was when the South Winooski Bridge and all of the debris came down and struck the end of the powerhouse. The water continued to come up. It got up, well, a foot or so below us. And poor Henry, he couldn't swim. But I could. Good, strong swimmer. And I had the bright idea that I could go out of one of the windows. I could dive down, go through the window, and there was a big elm tree, probably 50, 60 rods down, right opposite the powerhouse. And I felt as if I could make it. So I spoke to Henry about it. And please don't laugh, anybody, because this was pretty serious at that time. Henry, he didn't cry, but he was on the verge of it. He couldn't bear to think of being there alone. We had only 4 foot from there to the roof, and, of course, we didn't know. But he made me promise, and we shook hands on it, that he would edge over next to me so I could get a good swipe at him. He would turn his jaw the way I wanted him, and I was supposed to hit him hard enough in the jaw to knock him out if I possibly could. When he went into the water, I was supposed to hold him down, and that's what I promised. I would hold him down because when the struggling was over, then I would go through the window and take my chances. But the peculiar part of it was perhaps a half equals an hour, and it was up within 6 inches of the point that I was going out the window. When Henry says, "I think the water has stopped," wrong. We sat there a few minutes longer, and we decided it had. He inched over to me. We shook hands. I remember that very, and we said a prayer together. And we sat there from then. I don't know what time it was. I guess perhaps it was 2-3 o'clock on the 4th. And we sat there on the pipes until 4 o'clock. That afternoon. And then a canoe come down and picked up Henry. I helped him over to the window. Got in, and we landed on the second floor of the hospital on nightfall. They come back and got me. And that's about all I got to say.
Oh, my gosh. Wow. What a vivid memory. And what a moment to share. On the air, back then. So that would have been, what, about 77, right? It was the
Correct.
50th anniversary.
Yep, November 4th, 77.
Oh my gosh. 50 years later, he shares this incredible memory. I wonder if he told anybody that story, because it is something you really wouldn't share with anybody. And you thank goodness that the water ebbed when it did, right?
I just sat there thinking, I can't believe I'm listening to this and not knowing how it was going to turn out.
Oh,
I was so thankful at the way it ended.
Yeah, me too. Charlotte, as you were digging through all this audio, anything scandalous? I mean, I will admit that some of those sponsor calls that I used to have with Susie from Rabble Rouser Chocolates in the afternoons did require a cooling off period afterwards. but anything else salacious?
No, there were a couple of blooper reels where people use, you know, language that can't go on the radio. but no, and I kind of thought I might, because I know, when I record people in the mezzanine now, lots of times I just let it roll, because sometimes you get the best content when they don't think you're recording.
Exactly.
So I thought the same might have happened back then, but I haven't yet found anything scandalous.
All right. Let's have another clip. Is there another one you'd like to introduce?
Yeah. once I thought I had exhausted every area I could look for material, I was sitting in the larger side of the mezzanine one day, and the shelves there are about 12 to 15 inches deep. And I had looked through, you know, everything that was visible. I had pulled some carts away because some of the carts were stacked in two rows, and there's a section in there where we have dump music, music to go to the dump, buy old dump music that's on carts. And I had gone through both levels of those, and, you know, there was the tree climbing dog song, three or four copies of that. Osama got run over by a reindeer. But I thought, it looks like there's more depth to that shelf. I wonder if there's anything behind there. So I pull those carts out, and there's a reel-to-reel box, and it's labeled John F. Kennedy, Burlington, 11-6-60. So I've been burned enough times that I'm cautiously optimistic here. I'm thinking, what are the chances? And I'm thinking, I'm going to open this up, and the reel inside is going to say, flat nose the tree climbing dog or something. But I open it up, and it says Kennedy Burlington, the same label. So I think, okay, what are the chances I string it on the machine and it actually plays? You know, it's not sticky, it plays, or you know, what it probably is fragile, it'll break,
right,
or the audio will be so muddy we can't understand it. So I start the computer recording because you never know with these tapes what how many times you're going to get
catch
a chance
it the
to
first
play
time,
it.
Right.
So I string it on the machine, computer's recording, press play, and this is what I hear.
Governor DeBee, I hope Nick can't. Where is he? Come on over here. Of the elected governor and Lieutenant Governor Wilson to be. Let's say it. Now, I want you to meet three of my sisters. They have campaigned in 40 states in the last 14 years. And they have, so they're traveling around with us today. First, I'd like, they all are married to men who live in three of the most important electoral states, with the possible exception of Vermont, New York, Illinois, and California. It's been well planned. My sister Eunice Shriver from Illinois. My sister Patricia Lawford from California. Peter couldn't come. And my sister Jean Smith from New York.
Reference to Peter Lawford, the actor who married his sister. So that would have been like 2 months after the election in 1960, right?
No. So as I'm listening, I'm like, okay, yeah, that's John F. Kennedy. I Google, what was the date of the presidential election 1960? The tape says 11-6.
Oh, right. Oh.
The computer says 11-7, 1960.
This was the day
before. He's in Burlington.
Right.
So I continue to listen, and I hear.
Mr. Kennedy has asked that some of the press photographers and press men on the platform cut these shit down so that the crowd may have the full benefit of seeing and hearing him.
The more important than the committee.
So the content there doesn't really matter. What matters is that's Brian Harwood. So I call Brian up. I say, Brian, I found this tape squirreled behind all this dump stuff. It's Kennedy in Burlington the night before the election, and your voice is on the tape. And he laughs, and he says, oh, yeah, but the funnier part was I was standing on top of the terminal at Burlington Airport holding a microphone to record that.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, wow. You know, we rarely get presidential candidates coming to Vermont. It's just not that important a state. And it is, can be even mentioned, you know, the important ones electorally are New York, Illinois, you know, California for him. And yet here he was the night before the election campaigning in Vermont, in Burlington.
With his three sisters, too.
Yeah.
I mean, they're, it's not like they're not well-known.
Oh, that's right. With the three sisters. Oh, that's fantastic. Well, we can't play any more clips. I was really hoping we'd get to something called mystery recordings.
Well, you're going to have me back on.
Yes.
Because I need people's help with those. That's why
good.
I can't figure out why we have them, why they're important, why they've been labeled like they're important pieces of audio.
Oh, that's great. Oh, good. I shiver with anticipation. We will have Charlotte back. I love that, you know, most of my guests, once they get through their half hour, don't automatically volunteer to come back so quickly. This is pretty good. And I can ask even more pointed questions about your personal life the next time.
No, thanks. I'll just come with a lot of audio.
All right. That's wise. Actually, that's very funny. Charlotte did preemptively agree to be on the show and have a lot of audio pulled so she wouldn't be asked too many personal questions. This just shows how wise indeed you are, Charlotte Strasser. All right. Yeah, I can't wait. We get back to mystery recordings. I think we'll also hear Governor Snelling singing. Are you still going to be doing more archive digging? Will there be more stuff coming?
Yeah, if I have the time, I've got a lot more to go through.
Oh, that's wonderful. All right. Charlotte Strasser is WDEV's Director of Operations, responsible for a lot of the great sounds that you hear on a daily basis here on this station. Charlotte, thanks so much for being willing to come on the show today.
It's
this
a
was
lot
great.
Of fun.
I can't wait to have you back. Vermont Viewpoint is directed by Danny McGivergan, and it's produced by Rachel Connor, Zoe Helena, and Brady Jalili. Our email address, vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Feel free to suggest topics or guests. You can listen to past episodes of Vermont Viewpoint. You can download our podcasts at wdevradio.com. It's sponsored by The Warren Store, funky, friendly, and almost world famous. We've got Common Sense Radio up next with Bill Sayre, and I'm Rick Singeri. I'll meet you back here tomorrow. We've got Representative Peter Welch coming in. We'll also talk about dowsing, hiking, and of course, national correspondent Bob Ney will be with us. Thanks so much.